Here's Vivaldi's Largo from Winter, inviting you now to attend and attend to Evening Under Lamplight, coming to you from the vibrant Guido Street studios of Cambridge 105, Cambridge's community radio station. With me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, producer, compiler, promoter, presenter, oh yes, and engineer too. All these roles just to bring the very best in unorthodox radio to you, wherever you are right now as you're listening. Tonight, we're looking at the myth of Narcissus. For most people, Narcissus is just the archetype of self-love. But as I hope to show you, there's rather more to the story if we attend carefully. You may, if you go back that far, remember that I spoke a bit about this myth on our show back in August 2009, but that was only for a few minutes at the end of the show on Pairs. This evening, we will devote more time to getting inside this ancient and wise myth. Let's begin our look at narcissism with Thomas Moore, whose 1992 book Care of the Soul was perhaps the first to help me understand the deep spiritual insights we can find in ancient myths. Narcissism, Moore says, is the habit of focusing attention on oneself rather than the world of objects and of others. That's as good an opening definition as anything. It is an absorption in oneself that is soulless and loveless, and is regarded as a disorder in mainstream and Jungian psychology. But Moore asks us to think for a minute before we attack this self-love. Is our negative branding of narcissism, he asks, a defense against a demanding call of the soul to be loved? In other words, loving ourselves can be an important part of caring for our souls, which need love and goodwill as much as anything else in the world. And only once we discover the beauty that lies within ourselves and love that beauty, only then will we be able to put aside our ego concerns and allow ourselves to be touched by others. This, it seems to me, is the insight that comes to us from the Narcissus myth. But before we get into the story about Narcissus' struggle with his ego, let's have the Beach Boys. All right, the Beach Boys giving us advice about hanging on to our ego, the curse many people face. Hang on to your ego, but I know you're going to lose the fight. This is one of those ornate musical numbers from Pet Sounds, Brian Wilson's most ambitious album. I don't know if the musical arrangement completely overpowers everything else in the song, but see what you think.
How can I come on?
Beach Boys, Hang On to Your Ego. And now, on to our story. Myths, Albert Camus said, are made for the imagination to breathe life into them. And let's see what light we can breathe into the myth of Narcissus this evening. Narcissus was born from the rape of the wave-blue water nymph Liriope by the river deity Cephisus, who rolled her into the bed of a dark pool, then cast her up on the shingle, pregnant. That was Ted Hughes' loose translation from Ovid's Metamorphoses. Yes, there is something brutal about this impregnation, but that swift action takes us into this mythic world where we are suddenly swept up by forces beyond our control. It's a kind of other world where we are much more often out of control than in control of our lives. The story of Narcissus is a good example of that loss of control. The child born from this union was Narcissus. As the son of two water deities, he was destined to have some kind of connection to the unconscious, and we'll see more about that later. But the main characteristic of this child is that he was irresistibly beautiful. He had beauty that broke hearts, Ted Hughes puts it. He seemed so special that his mother took him to the prophet Tiresias to learn the child's future. Tiresias was an interesting figure since he had the unique distinction in the Greek myths of being able to see love from both sides, having been transformed at one point in his life into a woman, and then a little later back to a man. He was therefore not caught in just one perspective, but saw different points of view, male and female. This presumably is what gave him his wisdom. Liriope asks him whether her son would enjoy long years and ripe old age. Tiresias' answer in the Latin shows us an early example of the echo or mirror reflection motif that Ovid weaves through the story. Narcissus will have long life, Tiresias answers. Si se non knowerit, if he does not know himself. You can hear the echoes in the Latin. Si se and non knowerit. There's a kind of pun as though he is saying si si, yes, yes, and non non, no, no. Which is the answer? Yes, no? Who can tell? You remember the Delphic Oracle's famous advice to know thyself. But here such self-knowledge seems fatal. Well, sort of, as we'll see. So then, what is Narcissus's choice? Long years and ripe old age, or self-knowledge? What kind of life would that ripe old age be? Ripe for what? Is life without knowledge worth living? Socrates didn't think so. In fact, Narcissus is in the same position as Achilles, who was promised either long years and ripe old age, or fame and glory with a young death. He chose the second. These are heroes who choose intensity of living over mere extension of life. But as it turned out, Narcissus didn't have a choice. Self-knowledge came to him unawares, and so did his early death. But this death was actually a transformation and led to a form of intense ripeness. The story now jumps to Narcissus at age 16, when puer juvenisque videri. He seemed a boy and a young man. He's on the cusp, the time of a change in life. What is going to happen? Well, it's at this point that Narcissus shows the symptoms of what we commonly recognize as narcissism. Here's how Ovid puts it, and I use A.D. Melville's translation because it's very good and because he's a Cambridge academic. Community radio in Cambridge extends, surprisingly enough, into the world of Cambridge University. Many a youth and many a girl desired him, but hard pride ruled in that delicate frame, and never a youth and never a girl could touch his haughty heart. Did you catch the reflections there? Many a youth and many a girl desired him, but never a youth and never a girl could touch him. And why? Because, Ovid says, of his hard pride, his haughty heart. And it's time to stop for some music. Let's look at three songs about hard-hearted men and their narcissistic attitude towards those who love them. First, let's start with the Rolling Stones song, Heart of Stone. Mick Jagger's voice comes on, I think, sounding a little world-weary. It's hard being a tough guy lover. There's been so many girls that I've known. I've made so many cry, and still I wonder why. That sounds hopeful, doesn't it? He wonders why he's like this. But immediately he gets distracted by a little girl walking towards him. She's trying so hard to please, but all he can do is cry out that she'll never break, never break, never break this heart of stone. That sounds a little defensive to me. But this little girl seems different from the others. He can't make her cry. Now he feels even more threatened. And if she starts acting sad, it will only make him glad. Nice rhyme, Mick. And in the end, with a kind of compulsive self-revelation, he warns her to stay away from himself. You go on walking down the street, I ain't got no love, I ain't the kind to meet. There's something very nasty about this song with its droneful guitars and harmonies. Is this a soul song, a country and western song? No, it's a new kind of song, as we'd expect.
There's been so many girls that I've known. I've made so many cry, and still I wonder why. This heart of stone, oh no, no, this heart of stone. What's different about her? I don't really know. No matter how I try, I just can't make her cry. Oh,
Okay, from the Rolling Stones to the Kinks. There are some later songs about people afraid to show emotions and wondering how to get close to other people, but let's go instead with the early Kinks song Dandy, with a salute to Barry in San Francisco, who also came up with this idea. Dandy was released in 1966 on the A side of a single whose B side was Party Line, a song we heard on the last show. That's of no importance, but I'll let you know anyway. Ray Davis looks at the Dandy with disapproval, perhaps from the point of view of the married older brother reproving his younger brother's wild lifestyle. What an empty life, he says. Dandy, Dandy, where are you going to go now? Who are you going to run to? All your little life, you're chasing all the girls. They can't resist your smile. Checking out the ladies, tickling their fancy, pouring out your charm to meet your own demands and turn it off at will. And then come the warnings. It's the ant and the grasshopper story. Dandy, you know you're moving much too fast. And Dandy, you know you can't escape the past. Look around you and see the people settle down. And when you're old and gray, you will remember what they said, that two girls are too many, three's a crowd, and four you're dead. Oh, Dandy, Dandy, when you gonna grow up? Are you feeling old now? And then the kink in the song, the shift of perspective from moral judgment to a kind of envy. You always will be free. You need no sympathy. A bachelor you will stay, and Dandy, you're all right. I don't think that's ironic. I think it goes with other songs celebrating living by no man's code. There is, let's admit it, something enviable in Narcissus' freedom, and we feel that envy ourselves now and again. Attend to that confident opening and the jaunty guitar and bass dancing us through the lyrics. The song surely owes something to the sing-alongs Ray and Dave grew up with in their family's front room music gatherings.
Gonna run to all your little life. You're chasing all the girls, they can't resist your smile. Oh, they long for Dandy, Dandy, chatting up the ladies, tickling the fancy, pouring out your charm to meet your own demands and turn it off at will. Oh, they long for Dandy, Dandy, knocking on the back door, climbing through the window. Hubby's gone away, and while the cat's away, the mice are gonna play. Oh, you low down Dandy, 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 you know you're moving much too fast. And Dandy, you know you can't escape the past. Look round thee and see the people settle down. And when you're old and grey, you will remember what they said, that two girls are too many, three's a crowd, and four you're dead. Oh, Dandy, Dandy, when you're gonna give up? Are you feeling old now? You always will be free. You need no sympathy. A bachelor you will stay. And Dandy, you're alright. You're alright. You're alright. You're alright. You're alright. You're alright.
And one more narcissistic song. Our Dylan song, It Ain't Me, Babe. This is an odd song in that the tune is actually very sweet and lyrical, though the message is hard-hearted put-down. I suppose that continues the paradox motif that runs through the Narcissus story. We see this in the first line with its dismissive, "Go away from my window." What's she been doing? Peering through his window to see what he's up to? And then he allows her to leave at your own chosen speed. The singer rejects her, but pays her some respect. Is that kindness or even more of a put-down? I don't really care how fast or how slow you choose to leave, girl, as long as you just go away. In some ways, this is not a song typical of Narcissus, because this singer knows himself as Narcissus, by definition at this point, does not. I'm not the one you want, babe. I'm not the one you need. You say you're looking for someone, never weak but always strong, to protect you and defend you, whether you are right or wrong, someone to open each and every door, but it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe. You have to get the right kind of scorn in that word, babe. Go melt back in the night, babe. Everything inside is made of stone. And there it is, that heart of stone. And like the Rolling Stones song, he knows it. There's nothing in here moving, he says, and then adds, and anyway, I'm not alone. Really? Who's with this man of stone? In the context of Narcissus, we might want to say that his reflected self is there with him. He's not alone, but he has not yet seen this other who resides within himself. He has discovered all the things he is not and is just ready to find out who he is. It ain't me you're looking for, babe. No, it's this other self she's looking for. Maybe someday, as with Narcissus, it will come to the surface.
Go away from my window, leave at your own chosen speed. I'm not the one you want, babe. I'm not the one you need. You say you're looking for someone who's never weak but always strong, to protect you and defend you, whether you are right or wrong. Someone to open each and every door, but it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe. Go lightly from the ledge, babe. Go lightly on the ground. I'm not the one you want, babe. I will only let you down. You say you're looking for someone who promised never to part, someone to close his eyes for you, someone to close his heart, someone who will die for you and more. But it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe. Go melt back in the night. Everything inside is made of stone. There's nothing in here moving, and anyway, I'm not alone. You say you're looking for someone who pick you up each time you fall, to gather flowers constantly, and to come each time you call. A lover for your life and nothing more. But it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe.
That was Bob Dylan, and It Ain't Me, Babe. And this is Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge Community Radio, Cambridge 105, with your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson. We're trying to bring some light onto the Narcissus myth, or take some light from that myth. Robert Louis Stevenson, too, understood narcissism, but not the narcissism of hard-hearted lovers, rather the solipsism of the sulky teenager who thinks only of himself. In the essay Old Mortality, he describes his own narcissistic adolescence, when he would make himself unhappy by hanging around in graveyards. Only with the passing of time does the youth begin to see the world outside and realize that he is not the center of the universe. It's only in the course of years, and after much rubbing with his fellow men, Stevenson says, that the young man begins by glimpses to see himself from without, and his fellows from within. To know his own for one among the thousand undenoted countenances of the city street, and to divine in others the throb of human agony and hope. That's an important definition of narcissism and its opposite. The narcissist sees only himself from within, and others only from without. The mature person who has passed out of the narcissistic stage sees himself from without, to see ourselves as others see us, as Burns put it, and sees others from within, understanding their feelings and seeing things from their point of view. He sees himself as just one of many in this world, and he learns to sympathize with others who are tossed about with the same kind of emotional turmoil as he himself is. This is indeed what we all strive for, isn't it? Here, I'll read that wonderful sentence again, if you don't mind. It is only in the course of years, and after much rubbing with his fellow men, that the young man begins by glimpses to see himself from without, and his fellows from within. To know his own for one among the thousand undenoted countenances of the city street, and to divine in others the throb of human agony and hope. And then gradually Stevenson's active eye was caught by other people around him, and his curiosity led him out of himself, away from the narcissism. And even while I still continued to be a haunter of the graveyard, he says, I began insensibly to turn my attention to the grave diggers, and was weaned out of myself to observe the conduct of visitors. This was dayspring indeed to a lad in such great darkness. At least he was noticing other people moving beyond himself, and that was enough to start the transformation of narcissism. But coming to see the people around him was not the path Narcissus himself took, and we might understand why this did not work when we understand what lay behind his pride. See, I think it was like this. Narcissus would allow no one to touch him because he distrusted others. They wanted him, but he couldn't see the point. Why me? Oh, Narcissus, you're so beautiful, they'd cry. But not perceiving his own beauty, he couldn't see what they were talking about and thought they were just trying to flatter him or take advantage of him. So his heart wasn't really proud, though it was hard, and he was not really haughty, just immature, unaware of his self. And then the complication of the story. We focus in on one woman, a nymph who frequented the hills where Narcissus would go to hunt. Hunting being the activity in Greek myths followed by those who do not want to get involved with love or sex. This nymph was called Echo, and she suffered under a severe curse. We spoke a few months ago about hypocrites, people who play parts, and that's what happened to Echo. For whatever reason, she took the role of Jove's, that's Jupiter, Jove's accomplice. When he would be off in the woods having his way with some local nymph, Echo would stand on guard in case Jove's wife Juno showed up, and if Juno did show up, Echo would engage her in conversation. Nice hairdo today, Your Majesty, and that pin holding your gown up, it's marvelously crafted. Who made it for you? And then when Echo knew that Jove was finished and the nymph had left, she would back off and let Juno go on her way. Juno was no fool, though, and soon saw what Echo was up to, and punished her with the curse of never being able to speak herself, but only repeat the final words of what someone else was saying. Echo, you see, had become an echo. But she was also a woman in the flesh and susceptible to the intense appeal of Narcissa's beauty. She saw Narcissus and fell uncontrollably in love. But she couldn't tell him her love. She couldn't tell him anything until he spoke to her first. Ovid has a lot of fun with this. She followed him through the woods, growing more enamored the longer she looked at him. Narcissus realized that he'd become lost and called out for his friends. Now that he spoke, Echo was finally able to speak back. Here's Melville's translation again. He called out, "Anyone here?" And Echo answered, "Here." Amazed, he looked all around and raised his voice, called, "Come this way!" And Echo called, "This way!" He looked behind, and no one coming, shouted, "Why run away?" And heard his words again. He stopped, and, cheated by the answering voice, called, "Join me here!" And she, never more glad to give her answer, answered, "Join me here." Actually, in Latin, Narcissus says, "coeamus," which can mean, "let's meet." But when Echo repeats the word, it takes on the sexual sense of, "let's join up." Narcissus gave her just the word she was dying to say to him. So Echo now ran out from the wood to throw her longing arms around his neck. He bolted, shouting, "Keep your arms from me! Be off! I'll die before I yield to you!" And all she answered was, "I yield to you." Ted Hughes elaborates this final exchange. He has Narcissus say, "No, no, I would sooner be dead than let you touch me." Echo collapsed in sobs as her voice lurched among the mountains, "Touch me, touch me, touch me, touch me." It's not a happy ending for Echo. Rejected by Narcissus, she pined until her body wasted away and she became just a disembodied voice, the Echo as we know it today. This disembodied voice is another symbol, perhaps, of the same problem we have seen in Narcissus. He did not know himself. He was running around unconnected to his deep beauty. The curse on Echo was a similar kind of thing. Juno ensured that she would never be able to connect to her true self, or at least express it, but only reflect other people. The true self then withers away. And Thomas More adds that Echo's presence in the story suggests that the narcissist sees everything as an echo or reflection of him or herself. Let's stop for a minute, and let me read to you an interesting poem connected with echoes. It's an anonymous little poem from the English Civil War, predicting dire consequences for London now that political factions, called here siding, have forced King Charles to leave London. The poem is called "London, Sad London, an Echo." "What wants thee that thou art in this sad taking? A king. What made him first remove hence his residing? Siding. Did any here deny him satisfaction? Faction. Tell me whereon this strength of fashion lies? On lies. What didst thou do when the king left parliament? Lament. What terms wouldst give to gain his company? Any. But how wouldst serve him with thy best endeavour? Ever. What wouldst thou do if here thou couldst behold him? Hold him. But if he comes not, what becomes of London? Undone." Thank you. That was Les Éclairs de Musique, playing the second movement from Lotti's Concerto in Sol Maggiore, with an echo effect between the recorder and violin. But back to our story, where we are approaching the climax. What became of Narcissus? One of his rejected lovers cursed him. Let him fall in love with someone who rejects him as he has rejected us. The goddess Nemesis, the personification of retribution, heard and answered this prayer. It was just what Narcissus needed, a profound shock to throw him out of his immature position and help him see things in a new way. Nemesis seems at first an enemy, but she shakes us up for our own good. You'll see what I mean. In most myths and fairy tales, a curse can easily become transformed into a blessing. The presence of the goddess shows us that some sort of transformation can take place. Now, one day, while out hunting, as usual, Narcissus found himself in a secluded grove where no one had ever set foot before. There was a pool limpid and silvery, whither no shepherd came, nor any herd, nor mountain goat. And never bird, nor beast, nor falling branch disturbed its shining peace. Grass grew around it, by the water fed, and trees to shield it from the warming sun. These details tell us that this was a holy place, what Joseph Campbell would call a navel of the world, a center where things can turn right around for us. Thirsty, Narcissus stooped down to drink from a pool there, but suddenly he caught sight of his own reflection and immediately fell in love with the image. Of course he did. His beauty was irresistible, remember? We're often told to avoid looking at ourselves in the mirror. It just feeds vanity. You won't find mirrors in monasteries or convents, for instance. There's an interesting scene I recall in George Eliot's novel Felix Holt, in which two women stay up all night wrestling with some complex problem they have to deal with. One of them spends all night staring into the mirror. The other looks out the window the whole time. In the morning, the woman looking into the mirror is no further along with the problem. The woman who looked outside herself, however, has seen exactly what she must do next. But looking in the mirror can be a good thing, too. After all, it is essential that we know ourselves. I'm going to stop here for a song. It's from The Who, and perhaps it's a little too raucous for this still moment by the Sacred Pond, but I think it's relevant, and it contains, I think, one of Pete Townsend's most touching lines. And like Narcissus, he doesn't go in for touching very often. It's from the story of Tommy, the deaf, dumb, and blind kid who cannot connect to other people. A kind of Narcissus, as you see. No physical cures help him. No machine can give the stimulation needed to remove his inner block. It was trauma, not physical impairment, that left him deaf, dumb, and blind. And the healing can come only from within himself. The doctor tells Tommy to go to the mirror as a way to bring Tommy first to himself and then to the rest of the world. And meanwhile, deep within himself, Tommy's voice is crying out inaudibly for touch. He does not know how to express that longing, but we hear it. See me, feel me, touch me, heal me. This is probably a voice crying out inside most of us, at least insofar as we ourselves are versions of Narcissus. Well, I don't know how the sound of this track will fit into our show at this point, but let's give it a try.
He seems to be completely unreceptive. The tests I gave him show no sense at all. His eyes react to light, the dial's detected. He hears but cannot answer to your call. See me, feel me, touch me, heal me. See me, feel me, touch me, heal me.
Was The Who, Go to the Mirror, from that rock opera, Tommy. It's a song that I discover has a place among the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's 500 songs that shaped rock and roll. And so what happened to Narcissus when he looked into the sacred mirror of that pool of water? Water, you recall, is frequently a symbol for our unconscious. So the myth is telling us that this beautiful, unselfconscious boy looks for the first time deep within himself. And there he finds his true beauty. We are no longer talking about physical beauty, but that inner beauty we all possess, though few of us dare to look or acknowledge it. Only myths and fairy tales tell us of this. But just as he refused to let anyone touch him, so he could not touch this image he was in love with. If he reached out to touch the face in the water would ripple and the face disappear. If he moved back, the face too moved back. Here's Melville again. All he admires, that all admire in him. Himself he longs for, longs unwittingly. Praising is praised, desiring is desired, and love he kindles, while with love he burns. And so the story comes to its end. Narcissus cannot draw himself away from his reflection and pines away looking into the water. He dies and in death is transformed into a flower, the flower we know as the Narcissus, which bends its head as though looking into the water to see its reflection. Narcissus' transformation into a flower is, in this sense, a great fulfillment. As Thomas More says, a flower is flexible, beautiful, planted. And what is a flower, after all, but a thing of beauty that displays its beauty for everyone to see? Flowers do not run from their admirers, as Narcissus used to do. And now, once he has discovered his own beauty and learns to love it, he is free to let everyone come and admire him.
Thank you.
what more appropriate piece to follow the Narcissus story than Debussy's Reflets dans l'eau, Reflections in the Water, played here by Vlado Perlmutter. And let's finish with a few short poems by Walt Whitman, a poet always full of himself, but at the same time more open to everyone than any other writer. This first poem sounds like a repeat of Dylan's It Ain't Me, Babe, as he warns the new person drawn to me that he is not what this person expects from him. But this is not a rejection, it's a subtle invitation. Don't come to me because of my outward self, that may be all illusion. Come to my real self, the true me, not the public image, but the beautiful self Narcissus has seen in the pool. Are you the new person drawn toward me? To begin with, take warning. I am surely far different from what you suppose. Do you suppose you will find in me your ideal? Do you think it's so easy to have me become your lover? Do you think the friendship of me would be unalloyed satisfaction? Do you think I am trusty and faithful? Do you see no further than this facade, this smooth and tolerant manner of me? Do you suppose yourself advancing on real ground toward a real heroic man? Have you no thought, O dreamer, that it may be all Maya, illusion? Okay, then here is one of Walt's catalog poems, listing various flowers that reach out to all of us, but we have to be the ones to feed and water the flowers first. Then they give us their beauty. Roots and leaves themselves alone are these, scents brought to men and women from the wild woods and pond side, breast sorrel and pinks of love, fingers that wind round tighter than vines, gushes from the throats of birds hid in the foliage of trees as the sun is risen, breezes of land and love set from living shores to you on the living sea, to you, O sailors. Frost-mellowed berries and third-month twigs offered fresh to young persons wandering out in the fields when the winter breaks up. Lovebirds put before you and within you, whoever you are, buds to be unfolded on the old terms. If you bring the warmth of the sun to them, they will open and bring form, color, perfume to you. If you become the aliment and the wet, they will become flowers, fruits, tall branches, and trees. And one more poem, just three lines, expressive of the subtle electric fire animating Narcissus now that he can reach out and receive the love from others. O you, whom I often and silently come where you are, that I may be with you as I walk by your side or sit near or remain in the same room with you, little you know the subtle electric fire that for your sake is playing within me. And now we come to the end of our evening together under lamplight, here on Cambridge 105, you and me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. Bloomin' wonderful it's been, right? We leave Narcissus blossoming so that he can share his beauty with everyone, as we hope we too can first see our own beauty and then be generous in sharing it with others. I'll tell you something, though. It's not been easy finding songs for this show. You'd have thought there would have been lots of songs about mirrors or echoes or flowers, songs we could delight in attending to, but I couldn't find many others that would be appropriate. But there is one more song for us, and as so often happens, it's Leonard Cohen who closes off the show. This is a song from his last studio album, Dear Heather, 7 years ago now. It's an odd kind of song, and I wish I had the vocabulary to do it justice. It's one of those jazzy pieces where the poet sort of mumbles his words while the bass, sax, vibes, and drums play around in the background. The underground workings of the seed and the plant until about halfway through and Johnny Thomas comes in with her vibrant voice blossoming into morning glory. And Johnny Thomas has given us a peep into the way this song flowered. Leonard has always given me, she says, complete creative freedom on vocals. And although I've heard a rough track before the session, it doesn't mean I know what I'll do when I step up to the mic. This was especially true on Morning Glory. That's the song we're going to hear. On several occasions, we sat for an hour or two listening to the track, and he'd say, "This is going to be great. We'll just chant Morning Glory and maybe sing a few lines about how beautiful the Morning Glories are." Meanwhile, he hadn't written or recorded his speaking part yet, so all I knew about the song was that a 7-foot-high wall of Morning Glory vines in his backyard inspired it. He never knew this, but the more he played the tune, the more bewildered I became. It was so slinky and quirky that I had no clue what to do on it. I avoided that session for months until it was one of the last things on the record to complete. By then, I thought I'd just give it a shot, and it wouldn't be usable, but at least I did some other good work on the record. So we rolled the tape, and a minute of his monologue went by, and nothing came to mind. Another 2 minutes passed, and I was starting to sweat because I just didn't hear anything to sing. Leonard was sitting in a chair four feet away from me with his eyes closed, and he didn't seem perturbed. But I felt like I was really blowing it. As his monologue ended, I thought, whatever, and I started singing, "Oh, the Morning Glory." When it was over, I gave him a look like, how terrible was that? He nodded and said it was just what he had in mind. So I tripled that line, added the harmonies, threw in some glorias, and by then it really was rather beautiful. Well, now here are the words, which otherwise I doubt you'll be able to catch. We see Leonard in a world of no words, no direction, that confusion that met Narcissus in the pool, the necessary prelude to his flowering. No words this time, no words. No, there are times when nothing can be done. Not this time. Is it censorship? Is it censorship? No, it's evaporation. No, it's evaporation. Is this leading somewhere? Yes. We're going down the lane. Is this going somewhere? Into the garden, into the backyard. We're walking down the driveway. Are we moving towards, or in the backyard, some transcendental moment? It's almost light. That's right. That's it. Are we moving towards some transcendental moment? That's right. That's it. Do you think you'll be able to pull it off? Yes. Do you think you can pull it off? Yes, it might happen. I'm all ears. I'm all ears. Oh, the Morning Glory.
Transcendental moment. Do you think that's right?